WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton. Not the military industrial media. This is Active Ingredients. I'm Ed Russell. To repeat a secondary quote I once cheerfully received, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean there aren't people out to get you. You may trust in the knowledge that I was pleased to be offered such ultimately sage words of wisdom. Lately, I've had to ask myself, does fascism feel like fascism in its early days, or is it hindsight that makes it so apparent as a current fad? Anyway, perhaps in a sentimental act marking Constitution Day this year at Amherst College, two of three speakers with constitutionalist leanings were attorney Buzz Eisenberg and law professor Bruce Miller. Buzz Eisenberg is a professor at Greenfield Community College. He is a cooperating attorney with the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights, and a member of the Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative, giving representation to Guantanamo detainees. Bruce Miller teaches constitutional law and public law at Western New England College School of Law. First up, attorney Buzz Eisenberg.
It really is a pleasure to be here, and I'm grateful for the invitation. I'm glad to be here with Kim. Bruce, I've been pleased to be calling my colleague for a lot of years and a man I have an enormous respect for, as I do for Amherst College, for celebrating the Constitution. And that's the good news. The bad news is here we are celebrating the Constitution during what I've been calling for about 5 years now, the onset of the post-Constitution era in U.S. history. And I say that because the work that was just described that I've been involved in has led me to arrive at no conclusion other than we're carrying on despite the affront and the blows that are being delivered to our constitutional notion of a system of justice that's governed by the rule of law and that believes in principles like presumption of innocence and due process for all. It has been my unfortunate experience since December of 2004, when I first got involved in the representation of Guantanamo detainees, to watch those body blows that have been delivered to the Constitution, notwithstanding what I think are clear precepts that are time-honored and essential to any notion of a democratic society and a reverence for a notion of freedom. I first got involved, as I said, in December. I should back up. I was asked what I'm going to be speaking about, and what I was told is our rough division of labor tonight called on me to go first, and what Susan and others thought would be of most interest is for me to not prepare words or prepare a thesis to present to you, a white paper of some sort, but rather just talk about my experiences. And that given that those of us that are involved in this work have been to Guantanamo, have met with detainees, have dealt with the courts, that maybe I can offer a lens which might be of some interest to you into what I see. So what I'll do is try to my best to share my experiences with you. When I first started, Bill Newman and I of Northampton, of the ACLU, we co-counseled a case involving a young man, Abdul Salam al-Shahiri, who was barely 17 at the time that he was captured by the Northern Alliance forces in Afghanistan in 2002, I'm trying to remember dates. This happens when you age. he was one of the youngest. I think that, to my knowledge, he was the fifth youngest of all the detainees who were held at Guantanamo. Abdul Salam was released. He was Saudi. He had traveled first to traveled to Pakistan with his cousin, a 19-year-old, because his cousin, they were fairly affluent, and his cousin wanted to get laser surgery, and there was no place in Saudi Arabia to get laser surgery. There was a clinic that most Saudis went to in Pakistan And so Abdul Salam and his cousin both traveled on their first trip outside of Saudi Arabia. As I said, my client was barely 17. His cousin was 19, to Pakistan. But the guy who was supposed to do the surgery had gone on a travel with his family and wouldn't be back for 2 weeks. So they went to southern Pakistan, and they had a limited amount of money that they had taken with them, and they were told they could go over to Afghanistan and life would be really cheap there, so they could travel for a couple of weeks and return to Pakistan. Plus, it's an interesting thing to see the Afghani culture for people who have clean clothes and come from Saudi. So as Arabs, they traveled to Saudi Arabia, but unfortunately, September 11th happened while they were there, and the borders were closed, and they had no place to go. They were in a guest house, and they ended up being detained by the Northern Alliance, our allies, in the prosecution of the war on terror in Afghanistan. And he was taken to Basram Air Base, where he was treated unmercifully until he was shipped to Guantanamo and spent 5 years until June of 2006, when in the third mass release of that year of Saudis, there were 14 and 16 and 15. He was in a group of 15 that was returned to Saudi Arabia. So he's home and free, and thank you, doing fairly well, notwithstanding the permanent injuries to his body he suffered during his five-plus years in incarceration. Abdul Salam is not alone. There were, as a result of my representation of Abdul Salam, I joined the Saudi team, which is an informal sort of loosely coordinated affiliation of all the lawyers who had Saudi clients. We would do research together and work together. I think at the apex, there were 129 Saudis who were detained at Guantanamo. I think now we're under 40. Last week on Wednesday, 16 were transferred back to Saudi Arabia. One of them was held for a year in prison because there was an outstanding warrant for him when he originally left Saudi Arabia, so he was serving his time from a warrant that had nothing to do with the war on terror or the U.S. Prosecution of the war on terror. It was rather an internal thing. He served a year. The others, they serve a matter of days, weeks, or months. They go through this religious training again, and then they've, to a man, been released, with the exception of the 16 that went there Wednesday. I haven't heard about them, but I expect, like all the others, they'll be released. That means 40 out of the 129 are remaining at Saudi, less than 40. I think it might be 38, but for the same reason I can't remember dates, I can't do the math in my head right now. That's not an unusual story. We work in teams. Right now I'm on the Algerian team. We work according to nationality and ethnicity sometimes in coordinating our efforts in representing these men. We do so because there's quite often a sort of uniformity of either factual uniformity or on asylum issues, or for some other reason, it's good for us to sort of work together. But here are the big numbers. Here are the big numbers. And again, I might be off by a dozen or so. I think that there have been 774 men that have gone through what I call Hell's Lobby, Guantanamo, been detained there since the U.S., since January 11th, 2002, when the first men were brought there. 774. I think today there's about 340 left. I think today there's about 330 left. I just included the 16 that were sent on Wednesday. So if you do the math, that means like 444 or so have been released or transferred from Guantanamo. Those are just numbers, but the truth behind that numbers is this. You think about it. If these are the worst of the worst, as the then Secretary of Defense called them, if the Vice President was right and these were hair-of-the-dog terrorists, that's a quote, that these are the most dangerous men on Earth, that they're like animals that would chew through electric cable to do damage to the United States. If those are the men that are, have been at Guantanamo, then the only reason that the United States has released 55-60% of them, far more than are still remaining, is either you have to believe, either they have been rehabilitated because of the sophisticated correctional philosophy that we've used at Guantanamo, seen the errors of their ways, demonstrated their remorse, and we have let them go through the largesse of our big hearts. Or we let hair-of-the-dog terrorists that want to see your babies dead more than anything in the world go because we're that incompetent and the military is that myopic. Or we got the wrong guys. And we didn't know it because we didn't charge them and we didn't afford them that due process we say is a foundation of the very freedoms we say our people are dying for in Iraq. So we never had a chance to learn whether they were really the bad guys or not. I don't know of another possibility. That's my universe includes three possibilities. We fixed them. We let go really, really bad people. The kind we've spent all this effort and money looking for, or we got the wrong guys. I just came back from Guantanamo on August 30th. I was there for 5 days visiting two Algerians that I'm currently co-counseling with Jerry Cohen of Boston. We were supposed to go in July. We were told that we couldn't go in July. No lawyers could go in July because they were going to repave the airstrip that we land on when we come into Guantanamo. It's a small airstrip. It's long enough for a small jet, but not much longer. And there's another separate airstrip. And what they're now doing, we've heard, they secretly asked the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House Armed Services Committee to approve a plan to build a set of courtrooms at a cost between $91 million and $126 million, something like that, that those two committees in secret session last year objected. Those courtrooms were to be built in order to try these men, finally charge these men and try these men for being guilty of whatever it is we allege that they're guilty of that we're holding them for. And after Congress refused, I think what we now have learned, and I can tell you this because I thought I couldn't tell you this, but I can tell you it because it was reported in an AP article Friday that at a reduced cost of $10 to $12 million, they're building these tents on one of these vacant airstrips that we see as we fly into the base, where they're going to put a tent with 100 compartments that are shaped like Quonset huts, a series of tents, so that they can actually try what's rumored to be 80 of these men, 80 of the 340 that are remaining, to try them with the same kind of military commission that they used a young Australian man you probably learned of pled guilty in front of, and that a young man, Omar al-Qadr, they were beginning a trial and until the judge ruled that he was unconstitutionally being tried and throughout their system of military commission trial 2 months ago. Somebody help me here. Al-Qadr, about 2 months ago. Early June. So it looks, based on the information we're getting, that the military is planning on trying 80 of these men in these tents that they're now erecting. I sort of saw some activity and wondered what it was, and we learned what it was. That's important because it means 10%. It means about 1 out of 10 of the men that have so suffered and been detained there, that have never been charged, and all the things that I don't know the extent to which I'm preaching to the converted. I hope that some of you come skeptical about my position, so that I can open some eyes. It always feels better when I've opened an eye or two, and they said, oh, didn't know that, than when I'm with my brothers and sisters who already understand the nightmare that is the Guantanamo detention center. And the manner in which the United States has elected to prosecute the war on terror, a prosecution in theory that all of us are, I think, that I certainly am supportive of. I terrorists are not my favorite people, and I think that the horrors that terrorism can result in ought to be, we ought to have an effort to stop. But I think in light of why we're here tonight, it should be an effort that's constitutionally based, including presumption of innocence, including providing evidence to the people that you are trying so that they have the opportunity to refute it, including charging them and providing them counsel. Kim just misspoke by saying, how she asked a simple question, how long have you been defending these people at Guantanamo? And I corrected her, I hope not in an insulting way, by saying I'm not defending anyone. I wish I could defend them. You have to be charged to defend someone. I'm trying to prosecute a claim, claiming that, in fact, they're being unlawfully detained. That's what habeas corpus is all about. I think that on tonight's program, I think Kim is going to talk some about the Biden, about torture. I've talked to more detainees than I can easily count about their experiences at Guantanamo, some of them in Guantanamo and some after they've been transferred or released from Guantanamo, and heard about the treatment they received. But and there's so many lies that have been perpetrated on you. And one of the most recent lie that's being perpetrated on you is that torture has stopped. And even if the kind of waterboarding or the stuff that results in one of my client no longer has a kidney that functions, another client, even if that permanent, disfiguring, disabling kind of torture, horrific, unthinkable kind of torture isn't happening, all you have to do is sit across the table and look at a person who's chained to the floor and hear what their life is like from the time they wake up in the morning, a day full of isolation, a day without hope, another day without hope, another day without hope. And you understand that torture isn't just taking somebody's arm and bending it behind their back. The conditions of confinement at Guantanamo would not be tolerated in any state in this country, in any nation in Europe. There is no way to describe the torturous conditions of confinement of the men at Guantanamo Bay. Everything from the food allergies that aren't respect. Back up, rewind. Patty Prunhuber was asking me about one of my cases now, and I told her about Saeed Farhi bin Muhammad, that I currently represent, and I saw him in May, and he kind of said he wasn't feeling so well, and he sort of had some problems with his hands, some peeling of his skin, and I just saw him and walked in on Monday the 27th of August, and when the guard opened the door in Camp Iguana and let us in, all three of us, including the interpreter who has been through hundreds of these interviews, all three of us, we had trouble walking in because he is in such bad shape. I'm not going to graphically describe it, but I'll tell you that the skin all over his body is peeling off. I ought to talk to Marty Nathan, but we have other physicians working on it right now, but pustules and horrific things, and we sat with him for 2 days. It's been another 2 days with another guy, Al-Qadr, and I can't tell you what he said because my notes haven't gone through classification. There's a privileged team that has to declassify my notes before I could say anything in public. But I can tell you what I observed. That's not classified. And what I observed was a man who was shedding like a snake in front of me, so that every 15 or 20 minutes, I observed him humbly, embarrassingly, trying to remove the skin and place it on the floor underneath us so that we didn't have to be suffering seeing the skin that he was shedding that was in his eyes as he spoke. It was just a nightmare. And, of course, we did what we have to do. We filed the forms with the military back in May for him to get the medical treatment that he deserves. I consider that torture. I consider an a medical condition that goes undiagnosed or untreated, even if it isn't with some insidious motive like, you know, human intelligence gathering kind of motive. It's just a deliberate indifference to humanity, basic humanity that I thought we were all about before I got involved in this business. It's hard for me to share everything that I've seen at Guantanamo, except what I can tell you is that where I started is what leaves me at times despondent, but full of resolve. I do believe that we've embarked on the post-Constitution era of U.S. history. I think we're not aware of it because we're so comfortable. But everything that document is supposed to represent for us, that shining example of human potential, a government that's ruled by the rule of law, that's based on a presumption, at least that people get a chance to tell their story. That's what's at issue. Once again, the House Armed Services Committee, last week, Ike Skelton's committee, is going to be recommending a bill, what's called a chair mark, to be put on the floor of the House that's going to seek to restore habeas corpus. I think Bruce is going to discuss habeas.
Here and there, maybe.
The right of people to challenge in a civil proceeding whether or not they're being lawfully detained has been stripped of these men by a Republican Congress that felt that in the conduct of the war on terror, things like due process are not important. There's a Congress now that keeps entertaining the possibility of restoring those rights. There is a case you will be talking about with Median and Aldo Oda. There is a case before the United States Supreme Court, thankfully, that agreed to hear our argument that the Military Commissions Act, that habeas stripping act that was passed by that Congress, is unlawful, unconstitutional, contrary to common law principles, the great writ of habeas corpus, which maybe a little bit Bruce might talk about. And also that these men have the right to a hearing. The Supreme Court is doing that. Congress has the right to restore that. All we're asking for is the right to go into court, be charged with something, go in and have a trial, and if there's something that's secret or that impairs national security interests, for decades, for centuries, the courts have found a way. When somebody sues an FBI agent or when somebody sues a CIA, they found a way to preserve national security by court ordering people like us not to disclose. We all have national security clearance. We had to get it in order to represent these men. And we're constrained at peril of being charged under the treason statute should we disclose anything that we're not allowed to. So we keep arguing there is no national security imperative that prevents a trial. All we're looking for is a trial. Hi, Judd. For that reason, I'm hoping that what you all will do is, because we're going to be such compelling speakers, that we're just going to give you all the incentive necessary to run and write to the House, go online and find the address for Ike Skelton, the chair of the House Armed Services Committee, and urge him to mark up that bill. I think it's 2822, but I might be wrong. H-2822, I think. But it's the Habeas Restoration Act. And urge him to put it before Congress and make them consider it, make them vote it, because it's time these men had the opportunity to say, you got the wrong guy. It wasn't me. Thanks.
You are listening to Active Ingredients. That was Attorney Buzz Eisenberg speaking at Amherst College to mark Constitution Day. Next up, Bruce Miller. Bruce Miller teaches constitutional law at Western New England College School of Law.
Well, I also would like to very much thank our hosts here at Amherst College for having us here tonight. And I'm right now experiencing the great pleasure of being, I think, the optimist in the group. I'm usually called Chicken Little in these settings, and I don't think the things I have to say are going to be especially different from what I've said before. But I'm more hopeful than either of you guys. I think. I want to say something about this school. I don't know this school terribly well, but what I do know of this school, I truly love. I have three good friends who are Amherst College graduates, and one of them is actually here tonight. I may have more good friends than three that are Amherst College graduates, but the others haven't told me that they are. The first one was a guy from the class of 66 named Pete O'Loughlin, who also happened to be the power forward on my law school intramural basketball team. Pete's balance and good humor and good judgment not only got us through the first year of law school, which I know you can appreciate, but also the 1-19 season that we endured that year. The second one is my good friend John Weissman, who's sitting right over here, class of 1969. And John reminded me, and he probably needn't have, but since he did, I will repeat it. It was his class that stirred up enough good kind of trouble in another time of crisis to make the cover of Time magazine. And I'm ready for another Amherst College class to make the cover of Time magazine. John, who was forever and ever the leader, guiding spirit of the president of the Letter Carriers Union, he now claims to be retired. He isn't. He's spending all his time on Jobs for Justice, and he's done more for social justice, or as much. I mean, there's a lot of other contributors in this room that I recognize for social justice in this valley as anybody in the last 30 years. My third friend is closer in age to those of you who go to school here now. Her name is Amy Russo. And Amy took classes with me in law school, but prior to that, I hear tell, was a fairly decent hoops player for the Amherst team class of 95. What I know about Amy is that there was no such thing as a bad shot as far as Amy was concerned. She was shameless, and she had the range to prove it. She's now practicing law in Syracuse. It's Constitution Day, and I have a confession. I'm a constitutional law teacher, and I've been doing it for 27 years, and I think I filed the first lawsuit I ever worked on under the Constitution probably in 1972, which is 35 years ago. I vaguely knew that there was such a thing as Constitution Day, and I surely did not know when in the hell it was. And I'm actually pleased to know that it is right around the time of September the 11th. I think the actual time is September the 17th. And this means that every year we will, if we so choose, have the opportunity to take stock, as Kim and Buzz have just done. You know, there is a kind of interesting question, constitutional question about this, and it is, I just learned over dinner, that the federal government, this is, I guess, their version of Hallmark or something. The federal government requires every institution that receives federal funds to commemorate Constitution Day. And if you think about that, don't you wonder whether that's constitutional or not? And if you think about that anymore, you pretty soon are into an infinite regression here. And that's where we go. Kim, I want to say something about Kim's remarks. When I was a federal attorney 38 years ago, I guess. And it was another time when we had a president who said, if the president does it, it's legal. And he meant it, and a current president, I think, means it as well. And there were lots of people I worked with in the federal government who held beliefs that were not at all consistent with that, but they would have never spoken those beliefs publicly. And I think that was a time when it was a good deal easier to speak those kinds of beliefs publicly than it is today. I think it isn't necessarily remarkable, but it's certainly creditworthy that Kim comes here I think, from the belly of the beast. But you can tell that the beast has not chewed her up to say that the things that she said tonight. And I think maybe I'm going to have a fourth Amherst College grad as a friend pretty soon. So here, I want to tell you why I'm optimistic. Constitution Day, we take stock of the Constitution. You know, how's it doing? How's it holding up? And you know, of course, it all depends on how you look at it. But if you look at it from the point of view of separation of powers, I guess I want to say, in a certain formal way, it's holding up okay. Congress has insisted upon weighing in; they've weighed in. The courts have insisted upon weighing in; they've weighed in. What they've mostly done is said to the president, well, we're weighing in primarily in order to let you do whatever it is you want to do. Yet come to us and we will enable. And I think that's pretty much what they've done. So we have separation of powers, at least in form. But if what we're talking about in the Constitution is some sense of restraint of executive power by the rule of law, if that's what we mean by the Constitution as law, I guess I think it's fair to say, as Buzz and Kim certainly have suggested, that we are in some trouble, that we are in a period of crisis. But I don't think we're post-constitutional yet. You know, I'm with Yogi. It's never over until it's over. And I think there's a lot of reasons why it isn't over. First, I'm going to say a Latin phrase now, and those of you who are steeped in the classics, you know, weigh in and correct my pronunciation. I wanted to take Latin as an eighth grader. My school system had the great good sense to drop it, at least I think so. And as a result of that, I took Spanish for 5 years with teachers who for a while had me fluent, although I've largely lapsed. But here's the Latin phrase anyway. Some of you have heard of it. Intra arma silent legis. You get the roots of that. In war, the laws are silent. An old phrase. One that is in a way intended to summarize the view, I think, that with some despair, Kim and Buzz have pointed to. Now, I don't think our laws have been silent during this period. In fact, our laws have trumpeted fairly loudly. The problem is what they've trumpeted. And what they've trumpeted has been, by and large, that view of President Nixon's from 35 years ago, that if the president does it, it's legal. The president has said that. He has never said he's above the law. He's never disobeyed a court decision. He's never decided not to subject him or his administration to judicial process. He's always said he will obey, and he has. What he has done, though, is, I think, quite effectively deployed a pretty good legion of lawyers in the Office of Legal Counsel of the Justice Department, mostly, to make the case that the law is precisely whatever it is that the president says that it is. And the part of what I'm going to say in the next few minutes, I guess, that is pessimistic, is that I think that the other two branches have largely acquiesced in this view. But I have to explain to you why I'm a little bit optimistic as well. I think the game is just about up. I could be wrong about this, but I think it is. And the reason I think so is that there are more and more people in the executive branch and in the military who have raised their voices in resistance. And we have seen those voices of resistance begin to have a practical effect. And here I hope I'm right. Nobody should ever go to the bank on my predictions. Baseball, basketball, or politics, or law, any of the above. But I think we might be at a turning point that is a good turning point. So here first, how has the judicial branch acquiesced? The Supreme Court has decided four important cases concerning terrorism. The Hamdi case, the Rasool case, and the Padilla case in 2004, and the Hamdan case in 2006. In the Hamdi case, Hamdi was an American citizen picked up in Afghanistan and declared by the administration to be a, quote, enemy combatant. Enemy combatant was at that time a brand new phrase in American law and international law, unheard of before, never declared before. There were unlawful combatants, but not enemy combatants. President Bush insisted on his right to detain indefinitely at a location of his choosing anyone he determined to be an enemy combatant. The Supreme Court sustained that power with respect to an American citizen, said the president could declare that person to be an enemy combatant and hold that person for the duration of the hostilities. How long those hostilities would go would be undefined. The Supreme Court said, if they're going too long, come back, but the president has the authority. Now, this was an enormous victory for the administration, and it was an enormous victory for the administration because they were detaining people as enemy combatants rather than detaining them as prisoners of war. Buzz's point. Why were they doing that? Because prisoners of war have rights, and enemy combatants don't. And the point of enemy combatant declaration was to be able to hold somebody where you could interrogate them. Now, the Supreme Court knew that, and the reason they knew that is that the administration did not shy away from it in their brief. They said, in fact, the people they were holding were unlawful combatants. They were honest. The Supreme Court shied away from that designation, and they shied away from it because to say the president can declare somebody to be an enemy combatant is essentially to say, well, the president has the authority in a military conflict to decide who our enemies are. It's essentially a military judgment that the commander-in-chief can make. If they had used the vocabulary unlawful combatant and come out the same way, they would have had to say, my goodness, the president has the ability to make a legal judgment about who these people are. They're unlawful without any process. So I think they finessed that one. But the administration could rightly take the view that they had the ability to declare anyone in the world, even an American citizen, to be an enemy combatant. Due process attached, the Supreme Court said, very, very minimally, but the due process rights they made clear attached only to American citizens. That meant that the president could continue to insist that non-citizens held as enemy combatants didn't have these due process rights. That meant people held at Guantanamo didn't have to be given lawyers, didn't have to be disclosed the evidence against them. The minimum due process considerations that the Supreme Court said applied to American citizens didn't have to be applied to non-citizens held at Guantanamo. So Hamdi was a big victory for the administration, even though it's been portrayed as a restraint imposed by the court. The Rasool case, the famous habeas corpus case. See, there you go, Buzz.
Thank you.
Here and there, get into it a little bit. The famous habeas corpus case from 2004. In Rasool, the administration said, look, nobody held outside the United States has any constitutional rights, has any rights that we need respect at all. Guantanamo's outside the United States. And they cited a post-World War II case called Johnson against Eisenträger involving people who were held by the United States in Germany. These people had been convicted of war crimes in front of a military commission that met all the requirements of our Uniform Code of Military Justice held over in China. So they had a full trial, and they had been moved to the American zone in Germany after their trial, from which they challenged the fairness of the proceeding. The Supreme Court in that case, back in the 1950s, said, yeah, they don't have constitutional rights because they are non-citizens who are citizens of a country with whom we were in a declared war, and they were tried and convicted of war crimes. Well, the Guantanamo detainees hadn't been tried and convicted of anything. They were held in a place that nobody really knows the status of. For those of you who are lawyers in the room, the greatest property question in the world would be a landlord-tenant question based on the legal status of Guantanamo. When the property teachers start teaching that, we'll know that the millennium is close. I think that one might be a while. So Supreme Court says, look, the Guantanamo detainees are different. They're different. They're not the same. This is sounding pretty good. And they go through all the ways in which they're different. And then the paragraph ends. And the majority opinion doesn't say anything about whether these differences have any legal significance. They remark on the difference and just drop it. And then they say, never mind. We don't have to deal with this because we read Congress through the habeas corpus statute as having authorized federal courts to hear habeas petitions from Guantanamo. That's a fancy way of saying that the court said that Congress said that these detainees could bring suit. But it didn't say anything about whether they had any rights once those suits were brought. So the administration post-Rasul said, well, they can bring habeas petitions, but they still don't have any rights, so we're still not going to let them see any lawyers for purposes of determining whether they're enemy combatants. We'll grudgingly let them see lawyers for purposes of a habeas petition if some lawyer can figure out who they're representing and get down here. But that's it. So that's, you know, that is something of a victory. But it for our side, well, there I go, editorializing. It's because of your question, who favors torture? Well, nobody did, but there were a bunch of you who didn't raise your hands at all. And I'm assuming that's because it's hard to raise your hand in favor of torture. And it's also really hard, I think really hard, to say never, 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 even though some of us did and even though I would. But the administration, anyway, was able to continue to take the view, no rights, no nothing, no how. The third case, Padilla, was the one I erroneously predicted that the civil liberties side would win, because Padilla was an American citizen who was arrested in the United States and held declared to be an enemy combatant. They were going to have to order the administration to do something about this guy. Well, what they said was, oh, Padilla, you know, they had you in New York for a while, which they did, and that's where you first got represented by a lawyer, and that's where you filed your habeas petition. Wrong court. You can only file that sucker down in South Carolina, Jesse Helms' playground, where it'll be heard by a court down there. So Padilla has to go back and start over. And what the administration does with that, he goes back and starts over. The Fourth Circuit dependably says, yeah, you can declare him an enemy combatant and hold him indefinitely. And just as the Supreme Court's about to grant cert on that, the government says, never mind. We're going to take you out of defense custody. You're no longer an enemy combatant. Now that we've held you for 6 years, we're going to prosecute you. And that move presumably is also justified by the court. Fourth decision, Hamdan. The wonderful case of Hamdan, where the Supreme Court said Geneva applies. Trials can only happen if they're consistent with the Uniform Code of Military Justice. These tribunals are illegal. Well, the reason why Geneva applies and the reason why the UCMJ had to be applied was not because international law required it, not because the Constitution required it, but because in the view of the court, Congress had said so. Stephen Breyer, whom I love, my favorite justice, I think, essentially begged his readers, if you don't like what we're doing here, please don't get mad at us. Just tell the administration to go to Congress and get Congress to change their mind. And the administration's not stupid. They can read Breyer. Then they found something in Breyer they liked for a change. They took his advice. They went to Congress and got Congress to pass the Military Commissions Act of 2006. So what does the Military Commissions Act do? Strips habeas corpus jurisdiction from anybody declared to be an unlawful enemy combatant. Takes jurisdiction away from the courts to hear any other claim by anybody pertaining to their treatment who is an unlawful enemy combatant or detained at Guantanamo. Defines unlawful enemy combatant as anybody the president says is an unlawful enemy combatant. Precludes the citing of the Geneva Conventions in any case filed in an American court. And reinstates the military commissions system with essentially no requirement of disclosure of all evidence, essentially the whole program that Bush had adopted. So there it is. After 5 years, we are back with the administration essentially having won a full legal victory, but now one where his power no longer has to be asserted unilaterally. Rather, his unilateralism, I know this is paradoxical, has been endorsed by the other two branches. They've both said, go for it, my man. Do anything you want. And the president says, well, I will. Now you're wondering, this guy says he's not Chicken Little? All right, here's the good part of the deal. The good part of the deal. I'm going to give you the names of about a half a dozen people, and my guess is that you guys won't have heard of many of them. Charles Swift. You've heard of Charles Swift? Good. Good, good, good. Dan Morey, okay. Steve Abraham, nope, no Steve Abraham. Keith Allred, nope. Peter Brownback, now it's not Sam, it's Peter Brownback, no relation as far as I know. And Jack Goldsmith. There you go, Jack Goldsmith. All right, so, a handful of people. These six people from within the military and within the administration have raised their brains, hearts, and spirits in resistance to all of this. Some of them are conservative Republicans. A couple of them I thought I would never be able to have a beer with. I've changed my mind about all of that. Let me tell you what they have done. First, Dan Mori was David Hicks, the Australian detainee's lawyer. And what Dan Mori did is he fought for Hicks, not just in court, not just at Guantanamo, but he did, you know, what Patty and I do in legal services, you know. We try to fight in the court of world opinion. Now, I don't know who the Chief Justice of the Court of World Opinion is, but the way that Dan Mori did that was to go over to Australia, where Hicks was from, and become a public figure over there. And he essentially took the whole administration on. He worked with the Center for Constitutional Rights openly. He appeared in Robert Greenwald movies. He was a lawyer in the best sense. The reason why Henry VI said, first, let's kill all the lawyers. That's taken to be an anti-lawyer comment. It's actually an anti-royalty comment. So the first guy is Mori. Charlie Swift is Hamdan's lawyer. Hamdan was the plaintiff and prosecuting a claim, not defending, in the case challenging the military tribunal system and asserting the application of Geneva. Charlie Swift litigated that case with others all the way up to the top. For his trouble, he was denied openly denied a promotion. His career, in effect, ended as a result of his representation of Hamdan. He's no longer in the military. Dan Mori is. He's a graduate of our law school, and what I hear from Dan is that his career as a military lawyer is over as well. You know, I think he'll do fine elsewhere because of the reputation he's made for effective representation. Keith Allred and Peter Brownback are military judges at Guantanamo. And the move that they made puts all of us lawyers and law professors to shame. You remember that I said in Hamdan, the Supreme Court said, you can declare these people to be enemy combatants, but what the Bush administration really wanted was for them to be considered unlawful combatants. Because if you're unlawful and you don't obey the rules of war yourself, you don't have any rights. Well, you know, the Military Commissions Act was designed to, like, clean it up. And instead of just saying enemy combatants could be held and all these terrible things could be done to them, it used the word unlawful enemy combatants. Big mistake. Technical mistake, to be sure, but we lawyers love the technical, especially if it enables us to avoid the substantive. And what this is called is interpreting statutes against the backdrop of the Constitution, you know? And I love it. I love it when they do it. So here's what Brownback and Allred did. They said, wait a minute. The Military Commissions Act doesn't apply to anybody. It applies to no one in the damn universe, not one person, because there's not anybody who's been declared to be an unlawful combatant. Only enemy combatants. Words have their meaning, guys. All cases dismissed. These are military JAG lawyers sitting at Guantanamo in a chain of command. This was guts. This was heroism, in my view. So that's four of them. Now, Steve Abraham. Steve Abraham had as his wonderful job to be the liaison. He was the liaison between the intelligence agencies and the people doing the trials at Guantanamo. So he's the one who was the filter for all of the information, such as it was, that the government was proposing to introduce against people down there. Well, Steve Abraham saw that there wasn't any evidence being proposed to introduce. There was all just a bunch of crap, general allegations about people not wearing uniforms or being picked up in Afghanistan or being associated in Chechnya or Bosnia with somebody who had a gun. There was nothing. And so here's what Abraham does. Here's what Abraham does. Abraham goes to the lawyers who are litigating this Boumediene case that Buzz talked about. Now, Boumediene is an important case because it is the case in which the constitutionality of this Military Commissions Act is being challenged. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit in Boumediene held last spring that, in fact, the people held at Guantanamo had no rights under the Constitution, and therefore that Congress could indeed take everything away from them, no questions asked, no problem. And the Supreme Court, as some of you probably know, denied what's called certiorari. They said they weren't going to hear an appeal on this. But Justices Stevens and Kennedy wrote this weird thing that I've never heard anybody writing before. I can't remember what they called it. Do you remember what they called that thing, Buzz?
Denial of cert.
Well, they called denial of cert, but they added this thing called statement of Justices Stevens and Kennedy. And they said, we're voting to deny cert, but if any, I'm not quoting directly now, if anything fishy goes down, come back and see us. We might change our minds. So Steve Abraham reads this, and he says, there's fishy stuff going down that they don't know about. He goes to the Boumediene lawyers, and he says, smell the fish, and essentially goes public with all of this stuff. At that point, the lawyers in Boumediene go back to the Supreme Court, and on the last day of the Supreme Court term this year, after the horrible desegregation decision and all the other horrible decisions, the Supreme Court changed their mind and granted cert. Now, they had to. They had to. And the reason why they had to is that you had the D.C. Circuit saying, on the one hand, the people at Guantanamo have no rights because the Military Commissions Act took them all away, and because they're at Guantanamo, they have no rights under the Constitution. Guantanamo's not covered by American law. That's the D.C. Circuit. And these JAG lawyers sitting down at Guantanamo said, in effect, even if that's all true, you got to be covered by the Military Commissions Act to begin with for any of it to apply. Major contradiction. And then Steve Abraham comes out of the work and says, guess what? They haven't presented any evidence in any of these combatant status review tribunals. I'm here to tell you, I'm the filter, and there's nothing. So now they got to hear it. Do you see why I'm getting to be a little bit more optimistic? We have these acts of resistance that the authorities have to pay attention to. And if they don't, it's incredible public shame on them. Now, I've wondered, you know, where the level of shame began to kick in. But I think that it is there. I think that it is there. The last guy is Jack Goldsmith, who connects directly, Kim, to what you said. Jack Goldsmith was a pure-hearted Bushy, through and through. And he was high up in the Office of Legal Counsel. And when he arrived there, the Bybee memo that Kim talked about had just been written. And Goldsmith read it and was horrified. And he said, this cannot stand. 6 months later, you may have read that the Bush administration withdrew the Bybee memo. Kim told us about that. And substitute for it something that isn't great, but something that does acknowledge that we can't torture, that we can't engage in cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. Now, it's true that Bush still gets to define what those things are. But Goldsmith's act, I think, was an act, nevertheless, of tremendous courage. He resigned without fanfare on the day that he directed that the Bybee memo be withdrawn. And he hasn't said anything about it until yesterday. And there was an article in the New York Times Magazine, which I recommend to you, by Jeffrey Rosen, detailing Goldsmith's sort of crisis of conscience and the fact that he kind of came through it pretty well. So we got six people in the system who have acted in ways that stand much better for the rule of law and principles of restraint than anybody in Congress, and I want to say, I hate to say this, most of the members of the Supreme Court. And I think what they have done gives us hope and gives us spirit. The main card that the administration has to play here is fear. Fear. And if we've got people in the military who are saying this cannot stand, they've got a lot of credibility to tell us, you know, we're afraid of the wrong stuff. And it seems to me that this ought to really empower us as well to act further. Now, that's optimism, and I don't think it's pie in the sky. I think it's real. I think it's well-founded. I hope it is. I was in New York for a conference on this stuff on Friday and part of Saturday, and I went on Priceline and got myself a deal, and I was way the hell over there in Hell's Kitchen, but it was a cheap rate and good restaurants nearby. I had dinner with my daughter, but they gave us what passed for a continental breakfast, you know, and so there I am with the rinsed out, pretty much stale coffee and week old. I might have been a croissant. Not sure what the hell it really was. And of course the television set is on. And And Osama bin Laden has just done his latest press release, right? Press conference. Or video is what it is. I'm technologically illiterate. His video is sitting there. And it comes on, and there's maybe 30 people in the room, and all of a sudden everybody stops what they're doing, stops eating, stops talking, and is riveted on that video very solemnly. All of them. And I'm kind of watching, but here's what I'm noticing. The dude's beard is now jet black. That's what I'm seeing. And here's the thoughts that are running through my head. Bin Laden, I know he hates American consumer culture. I know he does. He's said so a million times. But he's been watching, for those of you who follow sports like I do, this is kind of all I watch is sports. You know those commercials that Walt Frazier and Keith Hernandez have been doing for Grecian formula? I think Walt Frazier's line is no play for Mr. Gray. You know, you got to have that dark beard, dark hair in order to, I guess, get the girls. And so here's Osama with his gray beard. And then is it any coincidence that in today's paper, Bush says, Grecian formula or no, Bin Laden is impotent. And I'm thinking that where we've gotten to now is some kind of virility war between these two guys. And so I have all of these thoughts going through my head. And I'm laughing. You know, leave it to me. I'll laugh at my own jokes anytime. I'm laughing at Bin Laden, but nobody else is laughing. Everybody else is looking solemn and worried and scared. And that, of course, is our challenge. And that's the challenge, I think, that these six lawyers have effectively stood against, an example to all of us. If of course, we don't meet it, pretty soon what's going to happen is on Constitution Day, we're not going to be able to talk because it'll be so dangerous for the terrorists to actually hear what free people talk about when they get together. Thanks a lot.
This is Active Ingredients. I'm Ed Russell. You have been listening to Bruce Miller. Bruce Miller teaches constitutional law at the Western New England College School of Law in Springfield. Before that was attorney Buzz Eisenberg. They spoke at Amherst College. This program is posted at www.activeingredients.org. Active Ingredients airs Mondays at 6 p.m. on WXOJ from Northampton.